Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. In his new piece in National Geographic, the Pulitzer Prize-winning environmental journalist Craig Welch writes about how the rapid thawing of Arctic permafrost across 9 million square miles at the top of the planet is writing a new chapter in the climate crisis story. He writes, quote, "From the unexpected speed of Arctic warming and the troubling ways that meltwater moves through polar landscapes, researchers now suspect that for every 1 degree Celsius rise in Earth's average temperature, permafrost may release the equivalent of 4 to 6 years worth of coal, oil, and natural gas emissions, double to triple what scientists thought a few years ago. Within a few decades, if we do not curb fossil fuel use, permafrost could be as big a source of greenhouse gases as China, the world's largest emitter, is today," end quote. Craig Welch is senior staff writer for National Geographic. Previously, he was part of a team that won the 2015 Pulitzer Prize for breaking news for coverage of the deadliest landslide in U.S. history. He has won many journalism awards from the National Academy of Sciences to the Society of Environmental Journalists. And Craig Welch joins us on the line from Oregon. Hi, Craig. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Before we dive in and talk about your piece, I just want to ask you about the fires in the Amazon forest that are getting global attention. There have been more than 72,000 fires in the Amazon. That's an 80% increase from last year. The Amazon is the world's largest and most diverse tract of rainforest. What are your thoughts about the impacts of these massive fires?
Well, it's definitely something that we need to keep an eye on. Brazil's new president, President Bolsonaro, has said he promised before he was elected that he would do everything in his power to make it easier for people to clear indigenous land. And so it's clear that most of these fires are intentionally set, and they have been set by folks taking advantage of the opportunity to clear more forest so that they can grow soybean and produce cattle ranching.
Right. And we're going to do a show about this and talk about media coverage on Friday. I also wonder what your thoughts are just about, you know, there's hashtags about the Amazon. We can actually see these fires. I mean, they affect so many people and animals and so many things on so many levels. But I wonder what your thoughts are about that, the fact that we can see these fires in the Amazon, whereas when we're talking about something like permafrost, most people will probably never go to the Arctic or Antarctica. And the photos in your piece are really amazing, but it's very different from fires. I wonder what your thoughts are on that.
That's a good point. I mean, part of the difficulty of having people understand what's happening at the two poles is it's an entirely foreign environment. We are all familiar with the Amazon either through photographs like those we're seeing now, or just the animals and the life that lives in the Amazon and its storied history. Antarctica and the Arctic are people often confuse them. I mean, one is mostly water that's covered with ice, and the other is mostly land that's surrounded by water. And the part of what my job is to take what's happening in these two poles, and I've been to both, been to the Arctic several times, and try to have people in our part of the world understand why what's happening up there matters to them, because it does matter to them. It affects us all.
How do you bring the severe impacts of climate change in those faraway places so people can really feel the same urgency as they do about fires in the Amazon rainforest?
Well, it's not easy. I mean, I think a lot of, for the last 10 years or so, people have talked about polar bears. That lack of sea ice and the loss of sea ice will make it more difficult for polar bears to live. Polar bears are now an endangered species in the U.S. Their numbers are declining in parts of the Arctic. And, that's one way people can grasp that. But, that sort of starts with a presumption that you're a person who has some sort of immediate attraction to megafauna. the reality is that what happens in the Arctic doesn't stay in the Arctic. So all of the changes up there will have impacts on us. They will impact they can impact our weather. I mean, the jet stream is influenced by what happens with the ice up in the Arctic. So there are a bunch of different ways what's happening there is directly relevant to you and me. It's just a little bit complicated to explain those piece by piece.
The pieces that you have done for National Geographic are just so incredible on many levels. I mean, they're both beautiful and pretty haunting when you think about what's to come. Your latest piece takes about 16 minutes to read. I mean, these are in-depth pieces. They're wrapped around gorgeous photographs and videos. What goes into putting these kinds of projects together?
It takes a lot of time. I first pitched the idea for this story not long after President Trump was elected. So it has been something that myself and photographer Katie Orlinsky have been living with for, you know, 2.5 years. You know, we spent many weeks in the Arctic, both in Russia and in Alaska. We took a pack rafting trip down an Arctic river for 9 days in Alaska. We spent time with scientists in Russia. Neither of these are easy places to get to. And then, you know, once we get back, you know, Katie spent time in the Arctic without me taking photographs. And then when I get back, I spend, you know, weeks and weeks and weeks on the phone with scientists. I talked to dozens of scientists and some of them dozens of times to make sure that we fully understood the implications of what we were saying. And then when our stories are finished, we then have a complete independent fact-checking process to go through and make sure that we're understanding this. So, you know, one of the advantages of working for a place like National Geographic is the stories are in-depth, but you can also trust them.
Well, I was just going to say, at a time when so many media outlets are shutting down, I mean, really important ones like Pacific Standard in our area, it's refreshing to hear this. It sounds like National Geographic is really dedicated to funding this kind of reporting.
Oh, absolutely. It is our mission. You know, we're trying to bring you the world, but that means in all its glory and all its fodder. I mean, everything we do to it is just as important as just how wonderful it is. And the only way we can do that is to make sure that people trust us, and the only way people trust us is to know just how hard we work to make sure everything is correct. I mean, we certainly make mistakes like anybody, but they are honest mistakes, and then we correct them.
Now, to talk about when you first started learning about Arctic permafrost.
Sure. So I've been in my previous job, I've been at National Geographic for about 5 years. In my previous job, I worked at a newspaper in Seattle covering the entire Pacific Northwest, including Alaska. So I've been working in and around Alaska on and off for 20 years. And I've had a lot of opportunities to visit Alaska and to think about permafrost. But when I was in 2015, the U.S. and 195 other countries met in Paris to forge the climate agreement that was attempting to have all of the countries set goals to bring our emissions down so that global temperature would not rise beyond 2 degrees Celsius. At that time, I spent a lot of time talking with scientists, and when I have free time, one of the questions I always ask them is, what are people not paying attention to that they need to? Mm. And one of the top scientists there said, somebody really needs to do a thorough look at permafrost and what risk that could bring to us. And so that was the genesis of this idea. And the idea being that we'd always known for 20 years or so, we knew that permafrost in the Arctic poses a risk to us for greenhouse gases, but nobody had really sat down and tried to get a handle on, as a journalist, to try to get a handle on everything we know and put it in one place so people can comprehend it.
So let's talk just generally about permafrost. So this is a layer of frozen ground that is hundreds of feet deep. Tell us more. What do we need to know about permafrost?
You bet. So permafrost covers about a quarter of the entire northern hemisphere. And the idea is that any ground that is frozen solid for at least 2 straight years is considered permafrost. And the entire Arctic is permafrost. Now, there are surface layers that are anywhere from a few inches to, you know, 3 feet deep that freeze and thaw and then freeze and thaw all year long. But below that, the ground, in some cases for 10 feet, in some cases for several hundred feet, is frozen continuously and has been for thousands of years. And this matters because there are all sorts, all of the animals from the Ice Age, the animals, the plants, you know, those things died 10, 12, 15,000 years ago, and because the Arctic is cold, they didn't decay. They just sort of ended up in the soils and over time got pushed down deeper and deeper into soil. And so all of this material in there, this is organic material that is carbon-based life. As the permafrost thaws, this material itself decomposes once it's exposed to warm air, and that decomposition releases greenhouse gases. And that is why it matters to us, or it should matter to us, how much permafrost thaws, because as all of your listeners know, we are introducing fossil fuel emissions into the atmosphere ourselves through burning of coal, oil, and natural gas. This is a form of natural carbon dioxide emissions that we are influencing that could actually make our own contribution worse.
And as you report, there's so much that we cannot see. As you say, permafrost covers an area more than twice the size of the United States, inhabited by half as many people as New York City, in some of the world's least accessible terrain. And little of it is actually monitored directly. You spoke with permafrost expert Ted Scher of Northern Arizona University, and he said you can go online and track exactly what happens to sea ice in the Arctic. With permafrost, we're barely looking. We barely have the tools to measure what's happening.
That's absolutely true. So permafrost, there are different types of permafrost. And this, I'll get back to this in a second, but that truly matters because in Alaska, where you have the University of Alaska and the University of Alaska at Fairbanks, you have a great number of scientists who have stations all around Alaska, the same with Western Canada, where researchers can go out and check these plots, and they check these spaces year after year over sometimes 20, 30, 40 years, and they can see changes over time. But then you look at all of Siberia and all of the Russian Arctic, and there just isn't that much research out there. So we have to basically look at these handful of stations and draw analogies and sort of make presumptions about what is happening in the rest of this space. Well, that is difficult because not all permafrost is the same. Some is simply frozen ground. Some is frozen ground that has solid blocks of ice trapped in the ground. And as that ice melts, the ground itself collapses. And when the ground collapses, it can fill with melting snow and water, and that creates pools. And there are tens of thousands of these small pools all over the Arctic now. And these pools, if you can imagine, you know, water is going to be warmer than frozen ground. Pools will continue to actually expand the frozen permafrost. Expand the melt of frozen permafrost.
And tell us a little bit about Sergei Zimov. He's an ecologist by training. You spent time with him in eastern Siberia. And talk about what his experience is like, the things that he finds when the permafrost thaws.
So Sergei Zimov is a very interesting character. He has been, you know, he was born in Russia in St. Petersburg. He's in his 60s now, and he moved to the far north to a small town called Chersky, and at the very tip of near the mouth of the Kolyma River, and when he was in his 20s, and he just was fascinated by Arctic research. He wanted to be as far away from the Soviet propaganda machine as possible so he could actually, you know, do real science. And so he has been up there working in these frozen landscapes for 40-plus years, and he's got this experience that very few people have had where he has been out, you know, watching the ground change and seeing how the landscape is differing. And there are places in this part of Siberia where you have buried, like, animals. You have buried mammoth bones. You have, you know, Siberian tigers. You have horses and bison that died tens of thousands of years ago. And he can actually go to some of these places where the permafrost is thawing, and the permafrost will actually emit. It's literally spit out old bones and mammoth tusks and femurs from a bison from 10,000 years ago. And he's been using this to essentially try to figure out how much carbon there is trapped in these Arctic soils. And about 15 years ago, he really upended this entire sort of science universe by convincing people from this research that there is far more carbon stored in the Arctic than we had initially thought, which means that we have to be that much more careful about how much we allow to thaw.
Right, because that means that the carbon will escape faster as the planet warms?
Absolutely, yes. So this is the reason that all of this matters, is that all of that frozen tundra that you see when you think of pictures of the Arctic, that's frozen ground, and trapped in all of it is plant and animal life. And as the ground thaws, that can escape, and it escapes as greenhouse gases, and it can escape in two different forms. It can escape either as carbon dioxide, which we're all familiar with, or as methane, which is 25 times more potent a greenhouse gas as carbon dioxide. And when you have this ground end up being covered in lakes, that makes it more likely that the gases that are being emitted are methane, which makes it a much greater risk because it increases the potency of the greenhouse gases.
You write that researchers now suspect that for every 1 degree Celsius rise in Earth's average temperature, permafrost may release the equivalent of 4 to 6 years' worth of coal, oil, and natural gas emissions. This is double to triple what scientists thought just a few years ago?
Yes. So really, just in the last, I'd say in barely over the last year, there was a woman in the University of Alaska at Fairbanks, a woman named Katie Walter Anthony, who is actually a former protege of, she used to work with Sergey, and she went out with Sergey, you know, decades ago, and he taught her how to measure gases escaping from lakes. And it's actually pretty amazing. What happens is the gases that are trapped in permafrost will literally bubble through lakes. And so you can actually go out and see bubbling coming up through these lakes. And the bubbles are typically methane gas. And in the wintertime, when these lakes are frozen, they can punch holes in the ice, and this gas will escape, and they can actually just hold a little torch to the gas, and it will shoot off a flame like a giant flare. So Katie Walter Anthony used this information and started tracking how many of these lakes were being formed across the Arctic, and then used a bunch of computer modeling. And by her calculations, anywhere from 125% to 190% more greenhouse gases are likely to be emitted from permafrost than what we thought just a few years ago. That research was done again by another team of scientists earlier this year, in May, I believe, and that was a Canadian scientist named Merit Turetsky, and she came up with looking at this sort of global picture of permafrost thaw and determined that it was at least double. So Katie Walter Anthony says it could be up to triple, and Merit Turetsky says it's at least double. And both of these were papers that were signed onto by some of the world's leading permafrost experts. So this is, it's brand new information. And one of the complications about all of this is most of the people in the world, the leaders of the world who are setting policy for us, get their information from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC. And the IPCC typically releases massive reports every few years detailing the latest in science. And they are very conservative about what goes into this science. They want to make sure everything that they release is agreed to by science panels. So this information is brand new, which means that the kind of information that people in Washington, D.C., who might be talking about a Green New Deal, they're basing their assumptions on what is now old information, which means that all of those assumptions could be wrong.
So this is really important. You report that the IPCC just recently started incorporating permafrost into its projections, but it still underestimates just how much havoc that could unleash.
Yes.
Right? And so this is really, I mean, you have this in your story. So to achieve the 1.5 degree goal, according to the IPCC, the world would have to cut greenhouse gas emissions 45% by 2030 and eliminate them completely by 2050. And so National Geographic asked Katie Walter Anthony and Charles Coven, a modeler at the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab, to factor in permafrost and recalculate the calculations. So what did they find?
So, yeah, and in fairness, I mean, this is very complicated stuff, and
right,
they were doing sort of back of the napkin math, but the point that they were trying to get across is because we've been basing our understanding of permafrost thaw on these old models that didn't take into account this process that Katie Walter Anthony and Merit Turetsky included, that meant that, you know, the folks in lawmakers in D.C. or elsewhere in the world are operating under old assumptions, and those old assumptions suggest that permafrost's contribution is important, but it's small, and when included, that means that if we were to cut emissions completely by 2050, that we had a reasonable chance of staying under 1.5 degrees. What Charles Koven and Katie Walter Anthony figured out by doing this calculation is that that is actually at least 20% too generous, and because they're not even considering these larger implications. So that would mean that we would actually have to cut all of those emissions at least 6 years sooner. And that, again, presumes that there are other sources of, you know, other sources that could produce ponds in the Arctic and therefore release even more carbon dioxide and methane.
So that would be 2044.
2044, exactly.
And what's so interesting here is, if this is happening so quickly, I mean, if things have just changed so fast in the last 3 years, what happens in the next 3, 5, 10 years with permafrost?
That is a fair question. So, and to be clear, it's not that the Arctic itself has changed that quickly. It's that our understanding of these Arctic processes is changing.
Right.
So what's happened with these ponds, for example, is, you know, we knew that they existed. We didn't know how to calculate what that impact was. And these two scientists really led the way in figuring out what those contributions would be. But even they acknowledge that there are things that we're just now figuring out. For example, in Russia last year, for the first time that they are aware of, Sergei and his colleagues, his family, went out and did some research and found that there were parts of the area around their hometown of Chersky, which is way up north, you know, 200 plus miles above the Arctic Circle, that were not freezing all the way through in the wintertime. And that's pretty unheard of. The Arctic is supposed to be frozen, the permafrost is supposed to be frozen year round, but the ground itself wasn't frozen even in the dead of winter. To make matters more interesting, when I took that information, it was not peer reviewed published science, it was just an observation. And I took that to the University of Alaska and said, what do you think of this? And there was a professor there who is largely considered the permafrost expert at the University of Alaska. He said, well, that's interesting because we saw the same thing here in 2018. So in Alaska, there were several other parts of the Arctic that also didn't freeze for the first time in winter. So the problem with that is the surface ground in the Arctic thaws and freezes all summer. It thaws all summer and then refreezes in the winter. So you're releasing some of these gases for a few months a year, every year. But now this allows it to release gases year-round, and that speeds up the warming itself. And this is a process that nobody really understood was possible before.
Today we are speaking with Craig Welch, Senior Staff Writer at National Geographic, and I hope you can take some time to read his piece. And even now, if you have the time, if you go over to yourcallradio.org, we have a link to his piece, and there are a number of photos which will give you just a better sense of what this all looks like. It's called Arctic Permafrost is Thawing Fast. That affects us all. As the frozen ground warms much faster than expected, it's reshaping the landscape and releasing carbon gases that fuel global warming. And as Craig reports, a lot of scientists say that this is just happening so quickly. We're talking about 9 million square miles at the top of the planet. Arctic permafrost is not thawing gradually, as scientists once predicted. It's thawing almost overnight. This is Your Calls One Planet series, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will speak with award-winning journalist Abigail Pesta about her new book, The Girls, An All-American Town, A Predatory Doctor, and the Untold Story of the Gymnasts Who Brought Him Down. This is about Larry Nassar. And then on Wednesday, we will do a show about the economy. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. If you'd like to listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, you can visit yourcallradio.org. Today on our One Planet series, we're speaking with Craig Welch, Senior Staff Writer at National Geographic. He has won many journalism awards for his work, and he's out with a lengthy piece called Arctic Permafrost is Thawing Fast. That affects us all. And I hope you can take the time to read the piece and look at the beautiful and haunting photos. And if you have any questions for Craig about what is happening in the Arctic, and if you have any questions about permafrost, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. And let's hear from Harvey in Berkeley. Hi, Harvey. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Rose, and thank you for the show, and thank you, Craig, for your most important work. Researchers from the University of Hawaii have found another source of greenhouse gases that are heating up our planet and speeding up the melting of the polar caps and our world's permafrost. And it turns out that most common plastics, when exposed to sunlight, emit methane and ethylene. And so plastic particles are found like in the atmosphere, oceans, lakes, rivers, on our polar caps, mountaintops. And that's an unrecognized source of greenhouse gas. So I'm calling on people to not use single-use disposable plastic products because they are increasing the speeding up of the melting of the permafrost.
Well, thank you for calling in. We've done a lot of shows about plastic, and we'll continue to do those. In fact, the Times had a piece about how the plastic industry is actually ramping up. Thank you. Let's go next to Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg.
Hello. I just had to turn my radio down so you wouldn't hear the feedback. Thank you.
Thank you.
I just wanted to ask your guest a couple of questions. One is, I was listening to a program on KPFA called Echo Shock, where a man was interviewing, I think it was an Australian scientist, and he was claiming, and it sounded like a similar claim to what you made, that the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, their estimates were incredibly conservative. And I think that things are infinitely worse than people are even imagining. And I'm wondering at this point, if that's the case, and we're going to see this, you know, even if we did a 180-degree change on where things are going, I'm not sure it would make a difference in terms of the climate. I'm not discouraging people from trying to do things, but I just wonder, this is starting to make me think that this is going to be a runaway train, and it's not going to be until things are really dramatically happening that people will finally wake up, and then it may be too late to try and do anything. Does he have any thoughts about that?
Well, I will say you're hitting on a key distinction here that's really important. Is there is the science of what needs to happen, and then there's the politics. And you know, I write a lot about science. I am no more expert on reading our political situation than anyone else. I do think there is a danger in having people feel a little too like that there's no recourse. And I also don't think it's true. I mean, one of the things that I did in this particular case was ask everybody, every one of the scientists I talked to, one of the last questions I asked them is, all right, so is this a reason for despair? And to a person, they said, no. You know, there are places, there are levels that we do not want to cross. There are thresholds we don't want to cross and how much we allow permafrost to thaw. But we still have time to change the course of this sort of physical system, if we do a better job of controlling our own greenhouse gases. Now, I don't want to pretend that that is an easy turnabout, but you know, we do have time. We just have to actually do the work to make that change.
Well, thank you for calling in, Greg. Let's go next to GS in South Lake Tahoe. Hi, GS.
Honored. I'm just terribly concerned about the imminence of this and the incredible importance of the regular people getting involved here. There is something we could do. We do have time, but not if we just dilly-dally and talk about it and argue about it. So what can we do, ordinary progressives, what can we do to make this like headline news? Because this is our planet. This is our survival. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, thanks for your question. I think the truth is that your timing is good. For first time in my adult lifetime, I think it is headline news. You've had presidential candidates now talking about you know what they think we should do, with each of them coming out with climate plans. You had, you know, the governor of Washington State, Jay Inslee, who just exited the presidential race, but not until he made everybody else start talking about climate change. It's on the front page of the New York Times and the Washington Post and in every issue of National Geographic. I think people are talking about it. As far as individuals, the most important thing you can do is talk about it to the people around you. Make sure everybody that you're talking to knows that this is not, it's not something that we can deal with later. We have to deal with it now. And then vote. Those things matter.
Well, thank you for calling NGS. I'm sure we'll get some more political calls, and it's just really hard to talk about the politics with this administration that even rails against windmills. I mean, it's just, you don't even know where to start with what the Trump administration is doing. But I wanted to also ask you in your piece, and I think this is a really important part of your piece, and that is how indigenous people are being affected by the permafrost thawing. You show a photo of Nikolai and Sveltana Lyaglovsky. Mm-hmm. They're an indigenous couple. And as you report, so many indigenous people make a living hunting and fishing. And some of their neighbors have been forced to move into town. The thawing permafrost is undermining riverfront homes and making the landscape harder to navigate. So can you talk about that piece?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there are only about 4 million people who actually live in the Arctic, but they see this day in and day out. They know firsthand just how much this is changing, and it can have direct impacts on their life. For example, most of the indigenous communities in the Arctic and on all of the continents have underground frozen caves that they build. That's how they store their fresh kills. If they go out and hunt a whale or hunt whatever their indigenous meals are made of, they use these underground caves to store the meat. Well, as the ground thaws, those cellars are collapsing and melting, and that leaves no place for them to keep this food. And so often what happens is they end up storing the food on the ground, and it either goes bad or it draws in other predators, polar bears and grizzly bears, and then there ends up being more conflict between humans and bears, which is also bad for people and for bears. And now that's just one of the ways. There are also, all of the structures that are built on permafrost. If the permafrost starts to thaw, then it's basically like having a mini earthquake. I mean, the houses, the bases of the houses crumble, the pipelines that distribute electricity or anything else from house to house, the water lines are cracking. There's one town in Alaska where the entire town now basically has to use porta potties because they don't have sewage treatment in the same way that they used to, because they can't. The pipes have basically cracked because the ground is no longer solid.
Wow! And as you report, when we're talking about the ice cellars, and you've got a photo with your story, a single whale can feed a community for much of the year if the meat and the blubber are properly stored. And as you write, as the permafrost thaws, these cellars flood. And I think this is so important, Craig, because the people who live off of the land are going to be hit first by all of this, and some of the most vulnerable, poorest communities around the globe. I mean, they're already being hit, and it's just so important to constantly go back to that when we talk about the climate crisis.
I agree. And not only are they first hit, they're almost uniformly the least of the contributors to the problem.
Right.
Those are people that we are literally doing things to, and we're doing them anonymously. We're driving to work or living in our homes with air conditioning and getting our electricity from power plants, and there are indigenous communities all around the world that don't have any of that electricity, but because of where they just happen to live, they're going to be the first to feel the consequences of these actions. And I'm as guilty as the next person. I'm an American. I live in a house. I drive my daughter to soccer practice from time to time. But these are habits we have to change on a much wider scale. We have to try and figure out a way to have a systemic change, because otherwise we are doing damage to people that we may never meet.
What happens to these people? I mean, what were the interactions like that you had? What stood out for you?
Honestly, I think what stands out when you meet indigenous people, particularly in the Arctic, is they're acceptance that they don't want this to happen, but they realize that they are they had the least amount of power to do something about it. And so, you know, they, you visit them and you say, what's changed? And there's this big sigh, and then they can say, well, you know, the animals aren't showing up in the same place anymore where we used to hunt. You know, the ground nearby is cracking. I mean, they're used to having to tell the story because they've been living with it a lot longer than we have. The consequences have been appearing in the Arctic for 20 years. It's just, it's more dramatic now, but the people who live up there have been noticing shifts for a very long time.
Mm. And can you talk more about the indigenous peoples? I mean, what changes would they like to see, given that they're being hit the hardest?
Well, I mean, I think it's also important to note that indigenous communities are not uniform in their beliefs.
I right.
think, you know, for the most part, the folks that I have met are, they want the opportunities that we have, but they also want the ability to maintain the lifestyle that their family and their ancestors have had for 10,000 years. And in order to do that, they have, you know, you can't go hunting whales without ice. You can't hunt anything on the ice if there's no ice in the summertime. And, you know, they have no ability to control that. At the same time, there are communities all around the Arctic that have been, they've been given opportunities because of oil development, and so they're, you know, it's hard to speak of them as one community with one voice, and so I think for a lot of them it's just as complicated as it is for us, that, you know, they have televisions and they drive cars and they have, you know, snowmobiles, all of which are powered by oil, so, you know, they have less of an ability to change it than we do, but, you know, it's, you know, it's a complicated question for everybody.
Mm, so true. There's many layers to all of this. Today we're speaking with Craig Welch, senior staff writer at National Geographic, and we're talking about his latest piece, which I hope you can take the time to read, Arctic Permafrost is Thawing Fast, That Affects Us All. And you can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's talk about how this is affecting the oceans. You write, what if the change becomes self-reinforcing, as it already is, for example, in the case of Arctic sea ice? Sea ice reflects the sun rays, keeping the ocean below it cold, but as sea ice melts, the dark ocean absorbs the heat. And you spoke with Chris Field, director at Stanford's Woods Institute for the Environment, who says, as a rule, the tipping points at which such feedback loops kick in are tricky to predict. He said, we know there are thresholds we don't want to cross, but we don't know precisely where they are.
That is true. I mean, there are part of what I was trying to get across in this story is that there are parts of the natural system that change, that the more we put greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, the faster they change. And in some of those cases, they will begin changing on their own. And that's what's happening with sea ice. That the sea ice, the more that sea ice melts, the more sea ice melts. It starts to be its own contributor to the problem. And the same can happen with permafrost. Now, it's important to actually make clear that very few scientists at this point think we're in grave danger of hitting that point with permafrost, where the permafrost starts speeding up the thawing, and that the thawing is contributing so much that it sort of creates its own self-sustaining problem. But we also know that we don't know where that line is. We don't know how much permafrost we can thaw before it starts triggering its own self-replicating problem. There is an argument that some have made that the same is true in the Amazon, that the Amazon rainforest contributes a lot of its own rain, so the more the forest that we actually cut down and deforest, the more likely we are to change the entire structure of that forest. And you don't have to cut it all down before it can actually start changing in a way that would lead to the destruction of large parts of the forest beyond what we've cut down. So we have to be careful of these sort of barriers that we acknowledge are there, but we don't know where they are.
We talked earlier a bit about just what we don't know right now. When it comes to permafrost, how much research is being done in other places around the world?
Quite a bit. I mean, there are the there's research being done in Canada and in Northern Europe and plenty in Alaska and in Russia. The problem is that the landscape itself is so huge that, you know, in Russia, for example, there are, I think, just three or four real hubs where most of the research takes place. In Alaska, you have people doing research all over the place. In fact, Alaska is probably the leading source for a lot of the research that takes place in the Arctic. Of course, a lot of that research in Alaska comes from the University of Alaska, and the University of Alaska is under financial pressure right now. So if the University of Alaska has to make some of the cuts that the governor is proposing, then some of the Arctic research would go away, and that would actually affect Arctic research around the globe because so much of it is done in consultation with folks at the University of Alaska.
What happens to permafrost layers under normal conditions?
Normally, very little happens. What you typically see is at the surface, the first foot or so would thaw and refreeze every year, and then below that, permafrost just stays solid, and it stays that way for thousands and thousands of years. So it is not a process really. At the surface, it would thaw and refreeze, and that's fine. That's normal. You know, the problem is that when the surface thaws year round, that makes it easier for deeper parts to thaw, and then that can actually, the more it thaws, the more it contributes to thawing of the surrounding ground.
Well, let's hear from another caller. Let's go to Olaf in San Francisco. Hi, Olaf. Welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks for... my question is about all this carbon that we're releasing, and now the numbers are getting bigger and bigger. Are there any options of taking the carbon out of the atmosphere? I'm not talking about sequestering, but using it as a building stone, because most of our plastics and oils are carbon-based. So are there solutions to sort of have a new industry sector of taking that sea out of the air and make it into some chemistry that we can use in our industry?
Well, in fact, yes. And to be honest, the IPCC itself says in order to reach some of the goals we've set for ourselves, we do have to find and advance technologies that can suck some carbon out of the air and find an economical way to store it, which probably means finding a way to turn it into a product. This is not something that's been talked about a lot because up until recently, it wasn't possible. But there is there's research being done in Vancouver, BC, and in Switzerland by a couple of different companies and it shows promise that we do have the technology to actually suck carbon out of the air and create something with it. The difficulty is it's incredibly expensive, and unfortunately, at this point, it's also very energy intensive. So it will require a lot of energy to actually suck CO2 out of the sky, which is there because of our energy use.
Well, thank you for calling, Olaf. You know, when we talk about solutions, Craig, I wonder what stood out for you when you interviewed all of these scientists. What changes, tangible changes, would they like to see?
I think, you know, one of the difficulties in my job is that when you speak with scientists who are experts in permafrost or experts in sea ice, they tend to be very uncomfortable getting out of their own lane. You know, they don't want to talk about, you know, they know that we need to reduce fossil fuel emissions. It's difficult to get them to talk about the best way to reduce fossil fuel emissions or what, you know, any of us can do to encourage that. But in talking to a lot of other experts, there seems to be a lot of people who agree that we need to have some kind of price on carbon emissions, something that creates a tangible value, so that we can say, you know, if you're going to emit this, it's going to cost something, and that money is going to be used to take carbon out of the system in another place. That is politically complicated, of course, but that is the best global way a lot of these scientists see to encourage people and have sort of the right incentive to reduce carbon.
And it seems like some scientists are actually right in that political debate, because the papers themselves are not going to force the change. We also need major political change. So we've had some scientists on who say, you know what, it's time for scientists to step up and really talk about this.
Oh, I agree. I have seen a great change in discussion among scientists about what role they feel they need to be playing right now. And I think there's a lot of there's a good argument to be made that these are the folks who understand this the best, and that, you know, without them being more comfortable standing up and telling us how we should make these changes, that we're stuck dealing with people who are less educated. And, you know, do you want a congressperson to tell you what needs to happen, or do you want them to take advice directly from the scientists? And I think that only works if the scientists are willing to speak up. And it seems more and more they are, because they recognize that that has been a fundamental failing of their industry. They're doing their job as researchers, but they also have to communicate with us what that means.
And Craig, in our remaining minutes, after the presidential election, we had a feeling that the media was going to focus on Donald Trump and his tweets, you know, nonstop, and that's what happened. And so we decided that every week we wanted to talk about the climate crisis, plastic pollution, overfishing, you know, farm workers, what have you. And so we do that every Monday. And I just wonder, given that you focus so closely on these issues, I'm looking at some of your past pieces, a couple of headlines: wildfire smoke makes Seattle and Portland world's dirtiest cities, half the world's orcas could soon disappear, how Amazon forest loss may affect water. You know, you've got so many pieces here about sea turtles, about overfishing. And I just wonder, what are your thoughts about all the knowledge that you have about where we are and, you know, what it will take to find the political will to actually take real action on these issues?
Well, I have to be honest that you can't do what I do for a living unless you inherently feel that there's a value in communicating these issues. And I do. I do think that, you know, I mean, when I talk to people who are in my sphere, I feel like I can actually share information with them, and that I've met people who have changed their mind or changed their behavior. And I think I am a firm believer that the best thing we can do as individuals is to talk to each other and inform each other. And so I think it's incredibly important. You know, I mean, there are days where I am surprised by how it does feel a little despairing, but then there are other days where I talk to people who are really excited about, you know, that this is a turning point in human history, and that we are on our way to someplace better. And I think that is possible too. You know, I think we just can't pretend that we can sit back and watch it happen. We have to be active players.
Mm. And I also wonder what your thoughts are when we say, what can we do as individuals? Of course, using less plastic, eating less meat, not driving, all that is so important. And but I also wonder, when we look at multinational corporations, how do you fold corporations into your pieces and the damage that they have done? I was just thinking when we were getting the calls about what we can do, The Guardian had a piece a couple years ago about how 100 companies are responsible for 71% of global emissions. You know, the usual suspects: Exxon, Shell, BP, Chevron, they're up at the top. But what are your thoughts about that?
I wish I had something insightful to say. I don't. No, I don't know. I know that is true, that there are that there is something inherent about capitalism and the sort of mega corporation that makes it ends up making decision making ends up being less about humanity than it is about profit, and that's the nature of the beast. And I don't know how you change that systemically, or if there is a way to get where we need to go without changing that systemically. But you know, I don't want to say that I need to stay in my lane, but I just don't have any more information about that than anybody else. I agree that it's something that needs to be considered.
And what are you working on now? What's your next piece?
So we have a special issue of the magazine coming out next month that will be focused entirely on endangered species. And I have a story that I worked on with another tremendous photographer, Thomas Peshak, on sea turtles, and sea turtles as sort of the canary in the coal mine for endangered species. And I will tell you that it is not all bad news. So, please take a look at it. The pictures are just incredible. And, there's some hope there.
Well, that piece is definitely next on my list. Sea turtles are down, but not out.
Yes.
Craig Welch is senior staff writer at National Geographic. And I hope you can read his piece, Arctic Permafrost is Thawing Fast. That affects us all. You can find a link at Your Call Radio, along with all of the other incredible pieces that Craig has written about orcas and whales, just so many different issues. Craig, your reporting's fantastic. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
Thank you. Coming up tomorrow, we will speak with Abigail Pesta about her new book, The Girls, An All-American Town, A Predatory Doctor, and the Untold Story of the Gymnast Who Brought Him Down. She writes, "We think of Larry Nassar as the despicable sexual predator of Olympic gymnasts, but there is an astonishing untold story. For decades in a small gym town in Michigan, he honed his manipulations on generations of aspiring gymnasts." I hope you can join us for that. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, yourcall@kalw.org. You can listen to past shows and sign up for our podcast at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show, and thanks to Kevin Vance, our studio engineer. You can find more information, yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call's One Planet series.